my goal with this talk is to provide a descriptive account of what's going on in First Amendment law and the ways that it might actually limit some of what the FTC may want to do, even if it has set its sights on what it thinks is the best policy. I'm going to be as descriptive as I can without letting my own policy preferences kind of shape that description, because I'll have a chance tomorrow to talk again about what I think about best policy. So I'm going to do my best just to be sort of honest about what's going on in the courts. But the courts are being quite active in this sphere, and you all should pay attention. Okay, so before I dive in, though, let me tell you a little bit about what I'm not going to talk about. I won't talk about restrictions on commercial speech. The commercial speech doctrine, it's a little bit misleading. It's actually a narrow category that covers just marketing messages and advertising. So some people sometimes think that commercial speech, which gives lesser protection to commercial, it's a doctrine that gives lesser protection, that would apply anytime someone's selling something to someone else, or anytime that somebody has a commercially motivated purpose to say something, and that's not accurate. Like, books are sold, right? And obviously books receive full protection. So commercial speech doctrine is narrow, and it's related to potential privacy regulation because privacy laws often have as at least one of their end goals to affect how marketers can craft messages. So in that sense, it may be related. Also, if companies are giving false assurances, either explicitly or implicitly, to consumers that their privacy is protected when it's really not, that's related to the commercial speech doctrine. The commercial speech doctrine doesn't allow any protection, any First Amendment protection, to false and misleading commercial claims. And that's interesting, and what it means to be misleading, especially when a company is committing an omission, when they're not saying anything, is still an open question about whether that is sufficiently misleading to remove the company from the ambit of First Amendment protection. And there are some papers, including one that I've written recently, that kind of tackle this question of who gets to decide what it is to be false or misleading. And by the way, I'm sorry, I mangled Rebecca Tushnet's article. Hers is actually called "It Depends on What the Meaning of False Is." I was writing these slides late, but we engage in a little bit of a debate about who should decide and whether the courts need to be involved. And it's interesting, but I'm not going to talk about it today. The other interesting thing that's out of scope for today is the compelled speech doctrine. So that's related to privacy because regulators might be interested in something like just-in-time privacy disclosures that make clear notice about what how a company is going to use your data. And we may be interested in forcing companies to actually provide these disclosures. And the Supreme Court has given its blessing to mandated disclosures that are purely factual and uncontroversial information. So maybe like nutrition labels on food items. I think most people tend to think of that as purely factual. But it's not clear whether a privacy policy would be, or mandated privacy policies would be, purely factual and uncontroversial. And I talk about this at some length in another article, so if you're interested in this topic, you can see my article that tries to map out what courts, especially lower courts, have done to decide whether a factual mandated disclosure is ideological and therefore subject to constitutional review, or merely informational and not subject to any amount of review. Interesting stuff, but we don't have time because I want to get straight to the core of what almost every privacy law is going to wind up potentially coming into conflict with, and that's a restriction on non-commercial speech. So this usually will happen in the course of privacy regulation through one of two ways. Either a law will put a limit on the transfer of personal data between, say, one company and another, or it will put a limit on the initial collection, or maybe even the initial inference, right, based on already collected data about a person. And, you know, almost every privacy law, if you think about the FIPS, the Fair Information Practice Principles, they usually involve giving the data subject some amount of control over these two activities. And that control necessarily puts a limit on these data transfers or the data collection. So much of what I'm going to say, but not all of it, is lifted from an earlier article I did called Is Data Speech? Asking, well, okay, is the First Amendment relevant here? Do we need to worry about potential constitutional review when we're dealing with data privacy? So let's start with the, that's right, to ground the discussion, I'd like to have you think in the back of your head thinking about the California Consumer Privacy Act, because I think that's, for many consumers, that seems to be a model privacy law. It seems to tap into what many people want, or at least believe that they want. The most important rights that are relevant for my discussion is that it gives Californians the right to say no. This is taken from the website of the designers of the law. It gives Californians the right to say no to the sale of personal information. It also, by the way, gives them the right to demand the deletion of personal data unless it's required for the service of the company. Just like with the GDPR, if a Californian does opt out of data sale, for example, they still must be given service on the same terms as somebody who has not opted out. But unlike the GDPR, it's an opt-out regime rather than an opt-in regime. Okay, so as I tell you about some of the case law, work with this hypo. Law professors love hypos, so ask yourself, okay, how does this affect the constitutionality of California's recently adopted but not yet implemented law? Okay, I'm going to start with data transmissions. These little stick figures are meant to be like companies or people who are selling data, and that red thing is data, right? So the first question that free speech lawyers generally ask is, well, is the First Amendment even relevant here? Does it cover this kind of activity? Would we call this activity speech? And I'm starting with this rather than the initial data collection, even though it usually comes later, because I think this question is actually much easier to answer. I think courts are converging on a clear, yes, this is speech, this is covered. So the Supreme Court itself in earlier cases had found that really dry information like credit reports or beer ingredients are speech. It really anything that communicates from one person or entity to another is speech. The lower courts, too, found that even in the context of privacy laws, the privacy laws may survive scrutiny, but that scrutiny must be used. Then the case of Sorrell versus IMS, which most of you don't know about, which delights me because I can tell you about it, really made this even more clear. So this was a case from 2011 or 2012 involving a Vermont statute that banned the sale of prescription data to pharmaceutical companies if the pharmaceutical company was going to use the data to fine-tune the detailing, basically the marketing, messages that it made for doctors. So the data did not have the identities of the patients, but the data does have identities of the doctors. So you can see it was justified partly on privacy grounds and partly on public health grounds. And as a privacy law, this seems rather narrow, but you can see how the implications might affect other types of, you know, broader privacy laws, because if you think of doctors as standing in for consumers here, the law was trying to give doctors the opportunity, they could opt in to this types of marketing messages based on their data if they wanted to, but it was trying to give them some control such that behavioral advertisers basically wouldn't have a lot of detail about their habits. So the Supreme Court, by the way, some commenters and even the circuit courts that were hearing similar cases before Sorrell was decided, thought that this type of law would fall outside the First Amendment protection completely, because data that's just like sitting in a server and that's just sold for these types of purposes is no different from any other product. I think the First Circuit even said it's like the equivalent of beef jerky, selling beef jerky. The Supreme Court definitely rejected that. So in an opinion by Justice Kennedy, he begins the analysis by saying, this court has held that the creation and dissemination of information are speech within the meaning of the First Amendment. Facts, after all, are the beginning point of much of the speech that is essential to advance human knowledge and to conduct human affairs. In the end, it got a little confusing because the case was ultimately decided on grounds of viewpoint discrimination, because what at least Justice Kennedy thought was the biggest offense about this law was that it prevented only pharmaceutical companies from using this type of tool to craft their messages to try to persuade doctors to do something. And it left open any other speaker who was trying to persuade a doctor to do anything else. It left access to the data open to them. So the case was ultimately decided on viewpoint discrimination grounds, but that dicta that came earlier seems pretty compelling, and especially because it's consistent with what the Supreme Court has said, or at least assumed in the past, that if something communicates, it's speech, unless it's in some very narrow special category like fraud, defamation, and a few others, incitement. Okay, well, all right, so a data privacy law might have to undergo scrutiny, or probably will have to undergo scrutiny. What level of scrutiny is going to apply? This question's much harder to answer. So a case called Dun & Bradstreet versus Green Moss Builders involved consumer a credit report, that was wrong, importantly, and in a defamation action, the Supreme Court decided that only intermediate scrutiny, you know, a lower level of protection applies in this defamation case because credit reports that are given to just a couple potential lenders are matters of purely private concern. So you can see a line with this case developing, emerging, that separates speech of public concern or general concern from speech of purely private concern. Dun & Bradstreet could have been limited to just defamation cases, but it has not been limited to that. So the Supreme Court itself has cited to Dun & Bradstreet in cases that have nothing to do with privacy for the proposition that speech of purely private concern is not as protected. So you might think, okay, well then privacy laws are going to have to only undergo an intermediate scrutiny, but more recently in Reed versus Town of Gilbert, the Supreme Court decided that strict scrutiny must apply to any law that on its face makes a distinction of any sort based on the content of that communication. And if you think about the California Consumer Privacy Act or many of the regulations that the FTC in the past at least has considered, or that is included in the GDPR, the linchpin for regulation is personal information, right? And it's defined in certain ways, and that's all about the content of the data. So if Reed is applied faithfully, it's not clear that courts will be able to do this, but if we're serious about Reed, then it looks like strict scrutiny would apply. At this point, I don't have a confident prediction about which level of scrutiny would apply. But going back to Sorrell for a minute, in the end, when the First Amendment is applied to some sort of privacy law, it's possible that courts could distinguish cases like Sorrell, because even in the opinion itself, Justice Kennedy said, well, perhaps the state could have addressed physician confidentiality or privacy through a more coherent policy. Now, some might object to the idea that the Vermont law was incoherent, because if it was targeting kind of the most obnoxious form of data sale, then maybe the legislature was right to just pinpoint that particular form of data sale and leave all others untampered. But if we take this seriously, then perhaps something like the California statute is more likely to survive because it's broad, because it's so comprehensive. I have some doubts, though, that there are at least a few reasons to think that the government would have to prepare strong arguments and a good base of evidence in order to defend even a broad, especially a broad privacy law that prohibits the transmission of data. For one thing, just in the past, even since the 1960s, the Supreme Court has listened to cases that involve the clash between privacy and the First Amendment, usually in the context of some sort of magazine publication, publication, and has found that the privacy interests are not compelling enough to outweigh the general interest in speech. The other thing, though, I'm going to skip this for a second in the interest of time. The other thing is there's been a series of Supreme Court cases, none of them directly related to privacy, but each of them showing that the Supreme Court is extremely skeptical now of any attempt by the government to justify what it's doing based on just kind of common sense ideas of harms or risks. So Brown versus Entertainment Merchants Association, for example, was a case that involved a California ban on the sale of violent video games to minors unless the minors had their parents' consent. And the Supreme Court found that the law was unconstitutional, even though the state brought a mountain of social science evidence with it, because the Supreme Court, rightly in my view, but obviously reasonable minds could differ, but the Supreme Court thought that social science evidence was actually quite bad. It was poorly done. So the courts are showing an increasing willingness to even look at the quality of the evidence that the government has and offers in order to justify their restrictions on speech. Let me spend just a minute talking about the data collection side of things. So for a long time, so this guy is using his cell phone, I guess, to record someone. So for a long time, the assumption was data collection is not protected by the First Amendment, even though subsequent publication of that information would be. So in a case called Deepman versus Time, the Ninth Circuit decided that Time magazine, they snuck a couple journalists into a quack's office, like a guy who just was waving wands and turning knobs and pretending to cure diseases, and they did an expose on him, and the court found that the actual publication was fully protected by the First Amendment. They couldn't be sued for public disclosure of private facts, a relevant tort, but the sneaking in of technology to record, to surreptitiously record what was happening, the secret photographs, that was completely unprotected, the court said. And the Supreme Court, in a case, Bartnicki versus Vopper, said something similar, that downstream publications are protected, but actually getting access to information or knowledge is unprotected conduct. It's just conduct. It's not speech. That always seemed weird to me, because if you think about the reason to limit data collection, it usually has something to do either with knowledge creation by the person who's collecting the data, or with downstream communications that person intends to have. And so if we think of both knowledge and communicating as being core to the First Amendment's goals, then why should limitations on collecting information in the first place get a free pass and not get any scrutiny at all? Well, sure enough, in the last couple years, this is a really recent development, but there have been right to record cases that are starting to chip away at this distinction. The first set of cases had to do with recording the police doing in public, and now every circuit that's heard these types of cases has decided that there is a First Amendment right to record police. The Seventh Circuit has gone further and said there's a right to record anytime you're in public. And then also, there have been successful First Amendment challenges to so-called ag-gag laws that prohibit people from secretly recording at commercial farms. And so that, too, is suggesting that even surreptitious recording, even in private spaces, has been getting increasing First Amendment attention. All right, so I raise all of these legal limits not to discourage the FTC in any way from crafting responsible privacy policy, but rather to, in a way, to applaud you for doing these types of hearings, because it's tempting to do something like what I think the FDA had done, regrettably, a few years ago, and to just kind of to plan to defend your policy later in court. but it will save you a lot of headache and heartache if you have a good evidence base and a good theory of what type of interest in seclusion or confidentiality you're actually trying to preserve in order to come prepared for First Amendment defense. The other option, of course, and this has come up already, is to actually prohibit disfavored uses that really are conduct rather than speech. So that's an option as well, and then you don't have to defend against the First Amendment at all. All right, thank you very much.